Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and we had hoped they were going to be the views of Ron Brown, who talks about gold and silver this evening for the next hour, but so far he's not answering our calls, so it's going to be open lines. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, wire telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, let's talk a little bit about what is going on financially. First of all, we've been trying to warn people for several years that we were going to get into terrible problems, because there is no instance in all history where nations have gone into a fiat money system and that nations have survived. And of course, this happened in ancient Greece. It happened in ancient Rome. In fact, if you go back and you read the writings of Aristotle said there's absolutely nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have perfect rulers. And but of course, he said that with tongue in cheek, because of course they didn't have perfect rulers in ancient Greece, and we don't have perfect rulers in America today. What people don't understand is that we have something called a fiat money system, where I should say a fractional reserve monetary system, where banks are allowed to create money out of nothing. They're allowed to perhaps have $1,000 on deposit and then loan out $9,000 based upon that $1,000 they have in deposit. And that, of course, creates great times, because, of course, the more money there is, the more prosperous people are, but there's nothing behind that $9,000 other than the debt. Imagine people were going to use that $9,000 to improve their home. Well, you could say, see, that home improvement is the basis of the money. So the money really has backing in that home improvement that took place, $9,000 home improvement. Everything is based upon debt. This is what people don't understand. Our whole monetary system is based upon debt. And if you paid off the debt, there wouldn't be any money. And this, unfortunately, is the situation we're facing today. Well, right now, of course, there are lots of things that are going on financially. Right now, the government is lying to the American people about inflation. They say we have 2.1% inflation. Well, that's the core inflation. But if you have to add, fuel food, why it gets up to 4%, they're concerned about that. But what they don't tell you is they have come up with a new means of actually calculating the rate of inflation, and they did this so they could cheat the Social Security recipients and people who are foolish enough to buy government indexed treasury bonds. Because, of course, if they can lie about the level of inflation, then they don't have to pay the retirees, the Social Security recipients, so much money. They certainly don't have to pay the people who bought index bonds, treasury bonds, so much money. And, of course, government lies. It is, by its very essence, is lying. And what they have done is they've come up with something called hedonics. And hedonics is simply a means of calculating the rate of inflation that really conceals the truth about what's going on, and making a lot of figures and estimates why they're basically deceiving the public. The rate of inflation today is somewhere between 10 and 11%, and many experts will agree upon this, that they cannot let the American people know. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Give us a call if you have a question or comment. It can be open lines, Friday evening, and we really are dependent upon your calling. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. So we're talking about the rate of inflation. Now, people don't understand that inflation is not rising prices. Rising prices is a manifestation of inflation. Inflation is a reflection of monetary policy, and when you increase the amount of money, you get inflation. You have more money chasing a certain limited number of goods, and it drives the price up. This is the way things have always been. Inflation is not higher prices. Higher prices do not create inflation. Inflation creates higher prices, just as wet streets do not cause rain. It's rain that causes the wet streets. And so what people are confused about the terms, but inflation is basically an increase in the money supply. Well, we've been increasing the money supply for years. In fact, the American government has been exporting our inflation. They've created all these excess dollars, but they've been able to export them to foreign countries so that foreign countries hold about $3 trillion of American dollars. They've got about $3 trillion out there that they're holding, and of course their value is going down all the time because of, well, inflation certainly brings a lowering of the value of the currency. And then if you look at the value of our currency and you evaluate it, for instance, in relationship to the basket of currencies, which was established some years ago, we were about 130. The dollar was about 130 to the basket of currencies, which was averaged at 100. And, of course, over the last two and a half years, it's fallen down to about 71. So we've lost well over 40%, or almost 40% of the value of the dollar. And, of course, this is one reason why the price of oil is going up. This is one reason why so many prices are going up, is because the value of the dollar is falling. And as long as we have to import oil, why the people who are producing the oil would like to make as much as they did a couple of years ago, and as a result, of course, they have dramatically increased the price of oil over the last couple of years. Well, let's go to Rick, who's calling us from Texas. And again, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. Hi, Rick. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Doctor?
I'm doing just fine. What part of Texas do you live in?
Oh, it's the east part.
Okay, fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, I've got a comment. You know, gold and silver, they drove it down this week, starting from Monday. I've got access to a ticker, and the ticker, you can look at 15 and 30 minute intervals going back the whole day.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Okay, we've got Rick calling us from Texas. Again, this is Open Lines Friday because our regularly scheduled guest didn't show up. So our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And if you'd like to give us a call, please do. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got Rick on the line who says he's got a ticker. Is that a stock ticker you got?
Well, it's for commodities. It's just a trading site.
All right, fine. Go ahead.
Put out by a gold and silver dealer.
Okay, fine.
But you can look at the activity of gold and silver, you know, as it progresses through the day, all day and all night, and mysteriously the ticker stopped between 3 and 4:30 a.m. Thursday morning. That's the first time I've ever seen it where there was an empty space. There was no, you know, bar graph, and it stopped at a certain point for both gold and silver, and then opened up a lot lower. Like gold was about $40 lower when it opened up, and silver was like about 60 or 70 cents lower when it opened up. So that just, I mean, plus there was a tremendous amount of volume this week for both of them. Gold was like three times the normal volume, and silver was about the same, about three times the normal volume. They have something called open INT, which I suppose is what is offered for the day, what people want to sell for the day. That's what I suppose it is. And usually the amount that gets sold is about the same Sometimes it's a little less, sometimes it's a little more. When gold goes up, usually it's about two times, the volume is about 2 to 1. Because, you know, a lot of people are wanting to buy in silver. Usually it's right about the same. But, man, the volumes on both of these, gold has been like 3 times and has been going way down, which tells me they're probably selling into the market. And silver is, you know, almost 3 times. So, and they just, it tells me they're dragging it down. I read on Kitco where people are saying, no, you know, it's institutional traders and hedge people that need liquidity. They're selling their gold and all this, but these major hedge institutions. But I don't buy it because Monday a bunch of news came out that should have driven the price of gold and silver up through the roof. First of all, they lowered the, you know, they lowered the
discount rate.
Yeah, by 0.75%, and also they opened up some new avenue. Window for, you know, a new gimmick for giving banks money, and there was a couple other things that happened that should have been a red letter day for gold and silver. But I was reading on Kitco, this one guy said, oh, but that was already counted into the market. Can you believe that?
Yeah, I can believe that. They'll try to convince you of anything. I have no question. I've been watching commodities for 43 years, in fact, when I was young and foolish, I even played the commodities without realizing that about 98% of the people who get into commodities lose money. Now, if this was simply a free and open market, you'd figure half would win and half would lose. This thing is so stacked, and they really do manipulate the commodity markets. They've been doing it for years, and they're doing it now because the one thing they fear is that the people will begin to reject paper currency and look for some stability, something that where the value of their and there really was very dramatic. There was silver went from about $20 and about 50 cents down to about
40 something,
right, down to 16, down to 16 something, and it's back to about
1688.
What that?
1688.
Right. Well, so
anyway, about 2147, say, or 41, somewhere around there to 1688. That's a $4.50 difference in 4 days.
It sure is, and you know it's being manipulated, but who are you going to report them to? The government? No, the government works hand in hand. What points you want to make before we let you go?
Well, it just that I noticed it took 40 days for silver to go from 1688 up to 21. And it took 2140 something, and it took 4 days to knock it right back down. So,
well, I think it's coming back again. We'll just have to wait and see.
Okay.
God bless. Thanks so much for calling, Rick. And keep an eye on those things. Anything good comes up, you let me know.
Okay.
God bless. And let's go to Jim calling from Chicago, and Jim wants to talk about Barack Obama. Hi, Jim. How are you doing?
How are you doing, Dr. Steve?
Doing just fine.
I live in Chicago. I've been living in Chicago most of my life. Up until Barack Obama ran for Senate, I would say 99.9% of the population did not know anything about him. I am just amazed of his popularity and the fact that he just came out of nowhere and, you know, one or two beats away from being the next president. And to me, it seems like it's almost demonic, you know, that people behind him are just doing everything to make sure he gets there.
Well, I think, of course, there has to be a force behind Obama. Certainly he's a very attractive individual. He's very articulate. He's very intelligent. He's calling for change, and who among us would not like to see a change for the better? But unfortunately, Obama has strong ties into Marxism and into the radical left. But there is a powerful force behind him. What people don't understand is that the presidential elections are a dog and pony show. They're simply to give the American people the feeling that we are going to pick our candidate, and then they're going to run one Democrat, one Republican in November of this year. And that's not the way it works at all. The elite pick all of the candidates, and then they see which ones they can sell to the American people. Now, certainly the media has known about Osama bin Laden, pardon me, about Barack Obama's radical left leadings for a long period of time, but they've completely concealed the information. Only recently has it come out. Senator Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, other conservatives have pointed to Obama's radical background, and of course now it's finally gotten out of the media. Obama's come forward with a very lame speech on race, you know, distancing himself from Reverend Wright, who he's been a disciple of for you know, for 20 years, Reverend Wright married he and his wife, and I think is the godfather of their children or something like that. They have lunch on a weekly basis. They've been doing this for many years. Obama may pretend to distance himself from Reverend Wright, but he really can't, I mean, because he believes, as Reverend Wright does, that America is a terrible country. Yes, we've done some terrible things, but it is not America. It is this small clique of wicked people who operate out of the elite organizations like the CFR and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. They're the culprits, not America. What we need to do is take America back. But I think you're absolutely right, of course, that, you know, Obama would be a very dangerous person to have as president. But then I think Hillary would be a very dangerous person to have as president. And I think John McCain would be a very dangerous person to have as president. So we're really not going to have any choice at all. But that's the way the game is played. They always run the candidates, and whatever candidate we vote for, why their candidate gets elected.
No, I would tend to agree with you. The other thing, it seems like the public that do support Barack, it's like they're looking for a savior instead of looking at themselves and realize maybe they did something wrong.
You're absolutely right. Obama calls for change. He wants a better America, don't we all? And it's a very clever gimmick, but he never tells you how he's going to do it. Special rates at the hospitals. But the hospitals still have to make money, so they just charge those people who are paying their own bills more money, and they're bankrupting people.
Right.
So the solution is not a new government program. The solution is to get government out of medicine.
Right. Not only that, though, where's this money coming from? I mean, the country's basically broke.
Well, nobody ever worries about that. You see, I mean, basically, we are broke. We're having to borrow a couple of billion dollars every day to meet our bills, and Obama, of course, wants to spend more money.
Wow. Well, Dr. Stan, thank you very much for my phone call.
God bless, and good to hear from you. Thanks very much. Our telephone number, again, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295, here in the Central Coast of California. This is Open Lines Friday, because our regularly special guest didn't come. I hope he's all right. He's a good friend. I really like Ron Brown, and we always look forward to our conversations with him. In fact, I've been looking forward to talking to him all day long. Well, right now we've got Daryl in Johnstown, New York. Hi, did you have a question or comment?
Yes, hi. Hi, Dr. Stan. Corey from WJIV.
Right.
Okay, yes, recently I've been contacted a few times by the John Birch Society, and I was interested in your view of the government's view of the John Birch Society. Do they consider them to be a subversive group or anything like that? Or?
No, I don't think that they have ever been considered subversive at all. I mean, certainly the John Birch Society, organized back in 1958, you know, has been very critical of the government, but not, you know, of America. They're very supportive of America. Most of the members are very, very patriotic people who are pointing to the danger of centralization of power in government and certainly the imminence of a dictatorship in this country. So, I mean, I think there are an awful lot of good people in the John Birch Society. I was a member. I'm no longer a member because of Zygmunt Brzezinski. And in his book he wrote back in 1970 called The Between Two Ages, America and the Technocratic Age, he said, look, we're going to take over this country, and we're going to do it by using radio and television. And the Birch Society said, we're going to try to change America by getting people to read, and the other side's losing, and we're losing. And so I figured that Brzezinski was right, and that's why I went into talk radio, and I'll hold on just a minute here.
Right.
Anyway, I'm no longer a member of the Birch Society. I admire many of the people there. I disagree with many of their policies because they do not identify what this real battle is, and that is the spiritual battle. And, of course, they do not really, of course, emphasize the importance of organizations like the Lucius Trust or the occult origin of the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral Commission. Unless we really look upon this as being a spiritual battle rather than a political or ideological battle, we will continue losing. That's why I'm not a member of the Birch Society, but many of my best friends are members of the Birch Society. I respect them. Are they doing the best they can? I just think that my method and my approach may be more effective in the long run. At least I hope and pray it is.
I agree with you as far as the media goes, as far as communicating. And as long as the Fairness Act doesn't, you know, come into play, we have to grab all we can with that. And I think you're right as far as communicating in that way. I know they have meetings and they'll have speakers and things like that, but I've never heard them over the air.
Well, because the thing is that those speakers are excellent, certainly their publication, there is no better magazine in America today than the New American Magazine. And certainly, Bill Jasper, who's a friend of ours, is the senior editor, but the former senior editor, William Grieg, appears here every week, and of course he'll be on the next hour. William Grieg was the former senior editor of the New American Magazine, and was, for whatever reason, let go. I think that was a terrible mistake on their part, but of course it was a wonderful advantage for us. We're so privileged to have William Grieg with us at least twice every week.
I hope he tells us why he was let go.
Well, we don't get into that. I think that, perhaps personality differences. And certainly, I do not in any way want to demean the Bird Society. I think they're doing a great job. I think that the majority of the people in the Bird Society are wonderful people, patriotic people, and many of them have given their whole life to this battle which you and I are engaged in.
Yes. Okay, Dr. Stan, thank you very much.
God bless, and thanks so much for calling. And let's go to Fritz, who's calling from Augusta, Maine. Remember, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. I would just make one more comment about the Bird Society, and that is that they've always had to live down the statement made by their founder, Robert Welch, that President Eisenhower was a communist. Now, I have never understood why Robert Welch made that statement, because Dwight David Eisenhower was not a communist. He was an internationalist. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was part of this whole movement to alter the structure of our society, but he wasn't a communist, and I think that this was a total misuse of words, and I have never understood how a man as brilliant as Robert Welch could have made such a ridiculous statement. With that as a background, let's go to Fitz in Augusta, Maine. Hi, Fitz. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Munchie. Yes, I would agree with that. He was firmly in the Marxist camp, Eisenhower.
Right.
For different reasons, the prosecution of the war, everything he did tended to go over that side, and certainly didn't support Joe McCarthy. So I see how he figures into it.
And I think the significant thing is he abandoned 20,000 American troops to die in Siberia. That was inexcusable. Hold on, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. It's Open Line Friday. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. We were talking about Dwight Eisenhower and, of course, Robert Welch's accusation that Eisenhower was a communist, and I think that was a very, very foolish thing to say. I do not believe that for one minute that Dwight David Eisenhower was a communist. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was certainly followed their policies. He was a globalist and internationalist, but he certainly wasn't a communist. But if you want to be critical of him, at the end of the Second World War, the communists held between 20 and 25,000 American troops that they'd taken captive from the Germans. And, of course, Eisenhower, rather than try to get those troops back and demand that they be repatriated, left them to die in Siberia. And that was unconscionable. And I could never forgive Dwight David Eisenhower for that. We have an image of Ike. I like Ike was the slogan that was used at that time. And in many respects, he ran a fairly conservative administration, but abandoning 25,000 American troops and then concealing that and leaving them to die a horrible death in Siberia is unconscionable. If anybody out there would like to verify that, we have the report that came from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee over the name of Jesse Helms. It's available. It's called a POWs, and of course it goes in the background. The POWs were abandoned after the First World War, the Second World War in Korea and in Vietnam. A very important document, totally suppressed by the media in America, but available from Radio Liberty. If you want to give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. So go ahead, Fitz. I'll try to be quiet for a while.
All right. Thank you, Doctor. Hey, I like your opinion on this as a physician. I found out some information that I found very, very disturbing. I had read about the Cord Meyer, the name Cord Meyer, was president of the World Federalist Organization, and Howard Hunt implicated him in the assassination of JFK.
Well, of course, many people felt that Howard Hunt himself was involved with the assassination of JFK.
Right. Howard Hunt's confession says that it was organized by LBJ through Cord Meyer.
It could very well have been. Certainly,
yeah.
LBJ was obviously involved in that. We have an interview. I interviewed Madeleine Duncan Brown, who was LBJ's mistress, and she tells how, and this is available, incidentally, in the Kennedy assassination update for tape set, and we have 2 hours with Madeleine Duncan Brown where she tells about the meeting that was held the evening before the assassination, where the plans were laid for the assassination, and how LBJ had come out of that meeting and whispered in her ear, well, after tomorrow, I won't have to worry about those blank, blank, blank Kennedy boys anymore.
Exactly, and Cord Meyer was the past president of the World Federalist, in other words, one world government.
Right.
Now, the problem is this. Timothy Leary wrote an autobiography called Flashbacks, and in this book he claims that Cord Meyer's wife was taking LSD with JFK. And eventually, Cord Meyer's wife was also murdered. Her name was Mary Pinchot Meyer, apparently to cover up the assassination. And
well,
Timothy Leary claims in his book that there was quite a ring of very notable people. They had the chairman of the philosophy department at MIT, people at Harvard were giving the students LSD. Just absolutely incredible story, the corruption going on in government. I guess the real concern there is you have a world federalist who Howard Hunt claims assassinated the president.
Well, I can't comment on that. I hadn't heard that. It's very interesting. Certainly, there is no question at all that JFK was murdered. Probably the mafia coordinated, but they were employed by the CIA. And of course, certainly we know that Nixon was well aware of what was going to happen, as was, of course, LBJ and J. Edgar Hoover and of course, Allen Dulles. And so many of these people were involved with the Warren Commission to cover up the truth from the American people. Anything else you wanted to say there, Fitz?
Well, the thing is for people to look into is the name Cord Meyer Mary Pinchot Meyer in the assassination of JFK.
What's the title of that book written by?
His book, Timothy Leary, is called Flashbacks. He was also romantically involved with Mary Pinchot Meyer. And he was very disturbed. Mary Pinchot Meyer came to Timothy Leary and said, my God, they've shot him. He wouldn't go along with their plans, and they've killed him.
Well, we'll take a look at the book, and thank you so much for calling.
Yes,
anything
thank
else,
you.
Fitz? All right, fine. Well, that's Fitz. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and right now, of course, we have Kurt on the line from Santa Cruz. Again, our number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Hi, Kurt. How are you doing tonight?
Fine. I have to confess to some terrible negligence. I'm only just now getting around to reading this wonderful book by John Stormer, None Dare Call It Treason.
Isn't that a wonderful book? Because it first came out in 1964.
Yeah, and I have a couple comments about this and a couple comments about Eisenhower.
Okay, go
World War II. The thing is that John Stormer makes some pretty strong statements about Eisenhower in this book that are not all that complimentary. He had a lot of questions about Eisenhower's behavior.
Well, I think there were a lot of things to question then about Eisenhower, but that wouldn't necessarily make him a communist, although it would make him a traitor. But then I believe that people who are members of the Council on Foreign Relations are traitors to America because their goal is a world government. And, of course, that means the destruction of the sovereignty of our nation.
But in relation to that and Robert Welch's statement, you know, the people that I ran into, you know, when I was informed by the communists at San Jose State, you know, the plans they had, and the Democrats wouldn't believe me and the Republicans wouldn't believe me, but boy, over at the American Opinion bookstore, they sure listened, is that the people in the John Birch Society in that era were very, very strong readers and believers in the things that John Stormer was saying. And, you know, Stormer's negative comments about Eisenhower, you know, may have been of something that was had a wider consumption at that time.
Well, of course, John Stormer was a very, very careful and a very astute observer. John's a personal friend of mine. I had the opportunity to get to know him very well. Roomed with him a number of times at meetings, and I believe his book, None Dare Call It Treason, which I think sold something like 7 million copies, is one of the most important books available. We actually still have copies of the original. We have
Wonderful.
His update called None Dare Call It Treason 25 Years Later. We recommend both those books, available from Radio Liberty. And the thing is that because Eisenhower did many bad things, and he really did do some terrible, terrible things, and he actually torpedoed the Bricker Amendment, which is one of the worst things. The Bricker Amendment was actually an effort to amend the Constitution so that the United Nations Treaty would never override our Constitution. And, of course, the Bricker Amendment was defeated by one vote in the United States Senate because of Eisenhower and his internationalist tendencies. He wanted the United Nations Treaty to be able to override our Constitution and destroy the freedom which we enjoy.
Well, that
hold that thought. We'll
sure.
be right back, Kurt, but we'll be right with you here.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly we've got Kurt on the line. Kurt, go ahead with your statement.
Well, you know, I've been studying World War II since, probably 1957, and probably have 2,500 books or more on it. And two things have always disturbed me, and I've asked historians about them all the time. The first one I kind of want to pass over and get to Eisenhower. But the first one was Mark Clark's walk in the sun in Italy. I mean, he just didn't do anything to prosecute that campaign. Rome was theirs for the taking, and they just sat there on the beaches and didn't take it. But Eisenhower's broad front strategy, to me, you know, I've studied military history, I don't know, 40, 50 years. Probably 50 years. That broad front strategy, to me, makes no sense whatsoever. It's like, it's other than possibly supply. It may have been supply. It may have been an overwhelming pressure from the British to front Montgomery, who just didn't go anywhere. But
could you explain to our listeners what the broad front policy was?
To go nowhere. I mean, the idea, the argument militarily, was that they had to go in a line across Europe and not have any salience sticking out, because the Germans could cut them off and wipe out a lot of troops.
Well, I think you have to understand the truth of what it was really all about. What Patton wanted to do. Patton wanted, of course, to take his tanks and just simply break through the German lines and head right for Berlin. But the policy in Washington, D.C., was not to be allowed, because they wanted the communists to take Eastern Europe. We could have actually got right through Berlin and taken all of Eastern Europe. But, of course, they wanted to turn Eastern Europe over to the communists. And so they had this broad front policy. They actually cut off the gasoline supplies to Patton, so he couldn't go ahead. Patton wanted to win the war. Of course, you know, America to win the war. Washington, D.C. and Eisenhower wanted to share that victory with the communists. And that's exactly what they did. That's why they fought the war that way.
But it wasn't just Patton versus Eisenhower and Montgomery. The general we had, I forget his name, down in the Vosges, was breaking through quite thoroughly, and they held him back, too.
Right. No, just as they held Patton back, you're right. Anything else, Kurt?
Well, so the question is, Eisenhower wanted to share victory with the communists, but I smell a rat of something deeper there. You know, why, you know, was Eisenhower a member of Council of Foreign Relations? I suspect he was.
Right, right.
Was he under orders, which it sure looks like,
yeah, sure
was he under orders to purposely lose by going slow?
Absolutely.
But who gave the orders and what were they?
Well,
who are they?
The man in charge was George Catlett Marshall at the time.
Yet Marshall in the 30s rebuilt the American Army from the square division, the triangular division, and he made an army. I mean, Patton's game plan was just Marshall's. I mean, so it wasn't really Patton. That was Marshall's technique. So why would Marshall, who had developed this lightning technique, hold it back?
Because he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations by this time and deeply involved with this whole world occult movement.
So who was giving the orders then?
Well, I think the people who control our military, and I believe it is this internationalist movement within our society who has always done everything they could to help communism create the best enemy money could buy. Okay, but, anything else, Kurt?
Well, the final point is the teaching of the round table is the circle within the circle within the circle within the circle. But who at that time was pulling the chains worldwide and perhaps pulling the chains for communism and pulling the chains for fascism? Who was in charge at that time running the game?
Well, it was the people who were, of course, running the Council on Foreign Relations at that time.
But who were they?
You're going to have to go back and look at the membership at that time. But certainly it's these internationalists, these people of great wealth, probably the Rockefeller or people that were affiliated with them were involved, but I can't give you the exact name. Certainly one of the leaders of this whole thing was John Foster Dulles. Another was Alan Dulles.
Uh-huh.
Another was Christian Herter. Another was, they were all disciples of Colonel Edward Mandel House. They'd been at Versailles with him in 1918. And there was this small clique of people who really were running our country from within the shadows and dedicated to bringing about this one world government, one world religion, and of course the one world leader. And that's exactly what's going on today.
Will you bring up one last question? Sorry. Who, is there any good biography of House?
A good biography of House? Well, of course, there's the intimate papers of Colonel House that were written by Charles Seymour, but Seymour also was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, so he really deleted a lot of the important things. The real story of Colonel Edward Mandel House will be found in his diary. It's back at the Sterling Library at Yale, and of course, you can go back and read it, but you can't copy it because it's copyrighted and it's been suppressed, you know, since what happened with Colonel House, wrote the diary, he gave it to Sterling Library about 1926, and he said this is to be sealed until 50 years from now, and then it can be published. Well, in 1976, Yale University was ready to go ahead and publish the things, and then Time Warner came in and offered them a lot of money so they could publish it. Well, they wanted the money, they gave the right to copyright to Time Warner, who was supposed to publish the diary. They've never done it. The best biography or autobiography of Colonel House is his own diary, and we have most of it here at Radio Liberty. I won't tell you how we got it, but I don't think it exists outside of my here and the copies I've made for a few people across the country, so that if they finish me off, other people will have copies of it. Anything else, Kurt? I've got a board full. I got to run.
I'm sure you. Well, I was going to say I'm sure you read but you've just said that you did.
Right. Anyway, God bless.
Yep. Good. Bye now.
Bye bye. And for the listeners out there, Colonel House is one of the key and pivotal figures in this whole movement. A man, of course, who controlled both President Wilson and President Roosevelt. A very evil and wicked little man. But what everybody has missed is he was deeply involved in the occult. And only when you understand that can you begin to understand why America has done what it has over the last century. Well, let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. We have Herman calling from Pacific Grove. We'll get to him next. And, of course, we once again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question or comment?
A comment, but I'd rather hear more of what you were talking about with Kurt. could I tell about the Pentagon report?
Sure, go ahead.
There's a new report just came out in the last week or so. It's called the Iraqi Perspectives Project, Saddam and Terrorism, Emerging Insights from Captured Iraqi Documents. If you just, well, I'll give the upshot of it all, and then I'll give some search words people can write down to find it pretty easy on the net. A lot of people have it now.
This is actually comes out of our own military, doesn't it? After they went through some 600,000 pages of documents. So go ahead.
This is from the Pentagon.
Right.
They've captured, at least this is what they say. You never know what to believe anymore, but this is what's out there right now, the latest thing. 600,000 captured documents, including audio and video, since the invasion of Iraq. They brought all that home and went through it for 4 years. This was actually finished, they say, about a year ago, and now there's some large PDF files you can download from a number of websites. The point is that while Bush and everybody were talking, you know, in 2002 and 2003, they were saying that Saddam's regime had ties to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda terrorist network. And this big report says, not true. Kind of amazing.
We
have these two major departments in our government now that seem to be at odds with each other, or at least they want us to think they're at odds with each other.
Well, I think the important thing, Mike, is the fact that we were told that, first of all, that we had to go in there because of Saddam had all these weapons of mass destruction. When they didn't find them, well, we had to go in because, you know, suddenly Osama bin Laden was working with Saddam Hussein, and somehow sort of Iraq was a base for al-Qaeda, and it really wasn't true. There were no al-Qaeda operatives in Saddam's Iraq because they would be a threat to his rule, and they just weren't there. And of course, they had to justify, well, Saddam was a bad guy, and we needed to bring democracy. But people have forgotten the United States government had financed Saddam Hussein. He worked for the CIA in the late 1950s. Anybody questions that? We've got books written 20 years ago that will bring that out. We financed him all during the 1980s. We kept him, and that is covered in an article we offer from the Washington Post called When an Ally Becomes an Enemy. And then, of course, during the 1990s, we kept him in power when his own army kept trying to overthrow him. That's covered in a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA operative who was operating and working in the northern part of the country there during the 1990s. In fact, Robert Baer's book, See No Evil, was the base of George Clooney's movie, Syriana. So we do carry that book. We have both the article out of the Washington Post. We have the book, See No Evil. We are available from Radio Liberty. And so all of these explanations that are given to justify the war are fallacious. We went in there, in my opinion, so that we could, of course, take over the country. People will say we did it for oil, and perhaps we're going to get some oil out of it. But the major thing is we want to keep our troops permanently in the Middle East, and this will be used as the base for the next world war, a World War III, which is in the offing. That's what it's really all about. But they can't let the American people know that, so they have to lie and lie and lie. And when the government lies to the people should be furious, especially after a million Iraqis have been slaughtered, and how many of our boys have not only been killed but crippled for life, and over a third of the young men who come back from the Middle East today within 3 months are ill, and many of them are severely disabled. And of course now the Veterans Administration is just too busy to get around to offer them any disability, and their lives and the lives of their family are ruined. Okay, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it just seems like with this report there's really nothing left as far as a so-called legitimate reason for invading Iraq. There's nothing left of the Bush administration's reasoning for doing this. I said I wanted to give some search words so people can find it fairly easily. If you just Google Iraqi Perspectives Project, Saddam and Terrorism, that'll get you to a number of websites. It's good to try and get one from a military website, possibly from the Pentagon website itself, though I haven't found it there. But I got mine from the United States Joint Forces Command, That's in Norfolk, Virginia. That's pretty close. I think it's in Norfolk. But that's about it. I think you need to move on to some.
All right,
calling.
Fine. Thanks very much for
okay,
calling,
thanks,
Mike.
Ken.
Very good. And I think that's a very important bit of information. We have it here. We'd be glad to provide copies if any of you out there listening audience would like to see it. Not, of course, the 600,000 pages, but at least the key to how to find them. Right now, we've got Herman calling from Pacific Grove. Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Good evening. Just got back from Borders. Picked up a book. I'm going to get over to you. It's entitled The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. The author is Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics.
I appreciate that. I've been wanting to get that book and read it.
Well, I've got it. I'm going to get it to you next week. But I'd like to pose to the listeners tonight. You know, do you feel that this war is worth $3 trillion? Because that will be the eventual cost. You have to read the book to get the numbers figured out.
The war is worth $1. I don't think that it was worth the life of one American soldier, and I believe that George Bush should be tried for treason for bringing us into this war and lying to the American people as to why we did it. It was all laid out ahead of time, and anybody who doubts that this was planned ahead of time, I suggest the book, The Price of Loyalty, by Paul O'Neill and Ron Suskin, and of course Paul O'Neill was the Secretary of the Treasury. And in that book, on page 96, certainly O'Neill talks about going to a meeting in February of 2001. What is this? 7 months before the 9/11 attack. And of course, at that point, why Cheney and Rumsfeld were saying, how are we going to get the American people to go along with a preemptive strike on Iraq so we can get their oil? How are we going to justify going to war? Now, this is 7 months before the 9/11 attack. Well, I think that we know how they were able to get the American people to go along with the preemptive attack. Something happened on September 11th. Go ahead.
Another interesting thing, Turner Classic Movies on their cable channel, they play a lot of the old movies that are like from the 30s, and a fascinating short film about 15 minutes long was played the other night. It's called The Man in the Barn, and it's a black and white movie, I believe put out in the 30s. It's about a man who was dying in 1903 or 4 on his deathbed, and he claimed to be John Wilkes Booth. And in this film, and they mention in there that the historians were consulted, they give all the discrepancies related to the murder of Abraham Lincoln and how Booth may well have gotten away and he may have had accomplices. And it's a fascinating little movie. If you can pick it up somewhere, like I say, Turner Classic Movies has it. It's called The Man in the Barn. So at the end of the question, because supposedly he died in the barn as it was burning and with a bullet, and there was a body taken out, but the people that examined it, medical examiners, even though he was a famous actor, all stated that they didn't believe it was him. Have you ever heard anything about that?
Oh, yes. In fact, we carry a book called The Elite Serial Killers by Galen Ross. And, of course, it goes into the murder of JFK, RFK, and MLK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and Martin Luther King. And it also goes into the murder of Lincoln, and it tells the story of Booth and how Booth actually was able to escape. He was an agent of the Rothschilds. He was paid to kill Lincoln, and he eventually went off to India and died. And, of course, it refers to a book that was written by his great-granddaughter, who actually had researched this whole story, and there's no question that he got away. And in fact, you know, he got away, and there's people, there's suggestions of perhaps other people who have been involved, and his acts, their death has been feigned.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I know of a very prominent talk show host who actually had suggested that the assassination of McVeigh, Timothy McVeigh, was fraudulent. I have a tape that he played repeatedly on his program. It records a woman who was there at the time of the execution. And her remark was, you know, on this radio program, gee, I didn't know you kept breathing after you were dead. I didn't know you kept breathing after you were dead. And of course, this talk show host kept playing that over and over and over again. And very shortly thereafter, he was killed by a police SWAT team. So these things really do happen in America. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Anything else, Sherman?
That's it. Just tell your friends, listen to Radio Liberty.
All right, fine.
Good night.
Good night. God bless. Well, that's Chris Herman calling from over in the Carmel area. And ladies and gentlemen, you know, if you get into the background of what really happened to John Fitzgerald Kennedy, there's no question that he was killed as part of a government-planned assassination through the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, only a very, very small number of people were involved, but they killed over 100 people who knew something about the assassination. Could that have happened just by accident? If you've not yet, of course, listened to our 2-4 tape sets on the Kennedy assassination, JFK assassination, the JFK assassination update, we think they're excellent. We have a DVD by our friend Bob Fletcher on the Kennedy assassination. We carry the book, one book, The Elite Serial Killers, another one entitled Kill Zone, A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza by our friend Craig Roberts. And I think if you read all of these, you'll understand that there's no question that there was a government plan to kill Kennedy. Probably one of the most convincing books is a book called Double Cross, written by Chuck Giancano, who is the brother of the head of the mafia, Sam Giancano. And he tells in the book how, of course, the CIA employed the mafia for their assassinations, not only in the United States, but throughout the world. And one of those hits was John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The book, Double Cross, by Chuck Giancano. And you can get that off of Amazon. And we think it's an important book. We hope that you'll get it. And of course, that you'll help us get the word out across America. And, of course, I think we're going to be putting together a four-tape set on the murder of Martin Luther King. And we actually now have four excellent interviews on this subject. There is no question that Martin Luther King was assassinated as part of a military hit coordinated by the mafia, probably arranged by the CIA, because Martin Luther King was going to lead a march on Washington, D.C., and he was opposing the Vietnam War, and he was asking for more government programs, and they were afraid they couldn't control the crowd in Washington, D.C. by killing King, Dr. King. They prevented that march. And you'll actually hear about the trial that was financed by Martin Luther King's family, where they charged one of the people affiliated with the assassination. And the jury found that the government was primarily responsible, the American government, primarily responsible for the assassination of Martin Luther King, and not a word in the controlled media. We carry the book, An Act of State, written by William Pepper. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we were just talking about, of course, the book written by the lawyer who represented Martin Luther King's family at a trial that was brought against one of the people who was involved with the murder of Martin Luther King, a man named Jowers, Lawrence Jowers. And of course, William Pepper was the lawyer who actually brought the charges and took them to civil court, and there was a jury, and the jury found that the Jowers was involved with the murder of Kennedy. Why? Pardon me, of Martin Luther King. Why? Because he eventually confessed to it. And, of course, they had his taped confession. But he had been hired by the CIA. He had been hired by the mafia. But it was assumed that they were being paid by the CIA. The murder was planned in his facilities, which is right across the street from the Lorraine Motel. And of course, there was an army sniper team that was there to kill Martin Luther King if the CIA sniper failed. Now, it's an amazing story. The book written about it is called An Act of State. We'll be putting together a four-tape set on it with interviews with four people who, in one way or another, researched this whole story. But the media refused to even mention this anywhere in America. Now, if this really happened, if there really was a trial, And there was a trial where the jury found that the American government was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King. Wouldn't you think some of the newspapers would have actually carried this story? But you can go to the King family website, and they have the entire transcript of the trial there. You can actually get, I think it's several thousand pages, but I suggest you get the book, An Active State, and we will have the four tape set available very soon. And what this really represents is the control of the American media. And again, the title of the book, An Active State. You won't hear it being talked about on most radio programs, because the last thing the establishment wants is for the American people to understand that the CIA assassinated John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and, of course, Martin Luther King and a number of other people right here in America. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, I should give our number to order the book. It's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And we do hope that you want to get the information we have. We hope that you want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, because you really can't understand the evil forces that are working in America unless you understand the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. We hope you want to get my talk on the forbidden secret. So that's my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. That is my talk on the forbidden secret. We have an excellent four-tape set on the secret, Behind the Secret, available in tapes or in CDs. We have a four-tape set on the supernatural. And, of course, a book that goes with that called The Beautiful Side of Evil. And it's written by Joanna Michelson, who was a medium. And, of course, she was deeply involved in the occult and what she thought were pretty true miracles until she realized that she was deeply involved in a satanic movement. And what she was witnessing was Satan's power to heal here in the... And, of course, it's an amazing story, The Beautiful Side of Evil. And, of course, all of these items are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are involved in a spiritual war today. We do hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us maintain our network across America. I should mention that this shortwave program, if you're listening to it now, as of next Monday, will change over to 5.875 megahertz. That's 5.875 megahertz and 6110 megahertz, 6.110 megahertz. We're changing our frequencies on March 31st. That'll be Monday. And then, of course, please tell others about our programs and encourage them to listen. What we need is as many people as possible listening to Radio Liberty, understanding the true nature of the battle, and helping us in this epic struggle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, who is formerly one of the senior editors of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, is a frequent guest here at Radio Liberty. He writes his own blog. He does his books. He works with the Welch Foundation. And, William, I'm so glad to have you with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, thanks so much for having me on again.
Well, what would you like to talk about? Do you want to talk about the economy, or what would you like to talk about?
Well, we'll talk about the economy, almost certainly. We just can't get away from that. And everybody seems to think that because the worst didn't happen this week, expectations have been engineered downward so low and so radically that we didn't have the catastrophe, the full-blown, fully-orbed, epoch-shattering catastrophe that everybody expects that we're out of the woods. And we're nowhere near out of the woods. As a matter of fact, we're just entering the woods. But there are a couple of other things I'd like to discuss that I think are very important. We just commemorated, or at least some of us did, the fifth anniversary of the Iraq War. And there were some things that were said in connection with that anniversary by the chief policymakers of the Bush administration that I think would bear some examination. One of them was an interview that Dick Cheney gave to Good Morning America, I believe the day before the anniversary. I think it was on Monday. He was, or not the day before, it was a couple of days before the anniversary. On Monday, he was in the Middle East, and a correspondent for Good Morning America pointed out that two-thirds of Americans say that the war in Iraq is not worth fighting. And Dick Cheney's reaction was, and I quote, "So?" And there was a rather long and uncomfortable pause, and the interviewer continued with the question, saying, "So you don't care what the American people think?" And Cheney responded, "No, I think you cannot be blown off course by the fluctuations in the public opinion polls." Now, a two-thirds negative rating in the opinion polls is not a mere fluctuation. That's a supermajority by constitutional standards, if you will. I agree we can't run public policy by plebiscite or by polling. That's not how it's supposed to work. We're not supposed to have a direct democracy here. But when you have, at long last, two-thirds of the public, according to fairly reliable public opinion sampling, saying that the war is a failure or saying that the war is a venture we should never have gotten involved in, that's a significant thing, and it should have an impact in a republic on the policy decisions of the people at the top of the executive branch and certainly in Congress. And Congress, of course, has plenary authority over questions of war and peace. They've abdicated that role to the executive. This is something which has been brewing now for decades. But during the Bush administration, it's got to the point where the legislature has almost entirely alienated its war-making role to the executive, as well as just about everything else. And I think Cheney's stolid, arrogant indifference to public opinion betokens the fact that we have an elective dictatorship in a very tangible sense.
I think it's really a more. I think it's more of a non-elected dictatorship.
And well, okay.
People have missed the point, and that is that Dick Cheney is a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah.
There's just about 80 members of this organization, headed by David Rockefeller, who really run this country, and they have for a long period of time. And it's about time people understand that. Of course, Dick Cheney was required to resign his position as a member of the Trilateral Commission when he became the vice president, but don't worry, his seat will be kept warm because his wife, Lynn Cheney, of course, took his seat. And until people understand that we have a non-elected ruling elite in America, they work through the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Bilderbergers, and they all tie back into the Rockefeller family. David Rockefeller was vice chairman of the CFR for 15 years, chairman of the CFR for 15 years. Today is the honorary chairman of the CFR. He organized the Trilateral Commission. He's a member of the Bilderbergers. I mean, we have a few people who really run America. America's unelected rulers. We'll be right back.
There is this sort of semi-submerged oligarchy in charge of things is something that's beyond dispute. The people are reasonably well-informed, and it's surprising the extent to which you can actually see in the so-called secular media, if you will, mainstream journals like the Washington Post, for instance, which has got deep and long-lasting connections to the CFR, the Council on Foreign Relations, which is sort of the senior member of that hierarchy. It's the big brother to the Trilateral Commission, so to speak. But every once in a while, the Washington Post, for instance, way back in 1993, the late ombudsman Richard Harwood wrote a piece called Ruling Class Journalists that talked about the role, the dominance, really, of the Council on Foreign Relations on the executive branch of government and in the media particularly. But you can see discussions of that every once in a while in ways that are really quite sedate and matter-of-fact, whereas those of us who object to what these people are doing, every time we bring up the subject, we're supposedly raving lunatics. I mean, it's a really good example of how they have the advantage of setting the dials and engineering the expectations of the public. I mean, that's their role, and the rest of us supposedly are fated to recite what they say, or at least work within the guidelines that they establish for us. But this semi-submerged oligarchy every once in a while really tips his hand as to what they really think of us. And Dick Cheney is really the oligarch par excellence. He looks, sounds, acts, and for all I know has the soul of Soviet commissar in terms of the wholehearted contempt, assuming, of course, that Dick Cheney has a heart, the wholehearted contempt that he has for those of us who are the raw material of his ambitions, and the fact that he would react to that question that way and very brazenly declaim upon the completely inconsequential role of public opinion in the making of public policy is rather breathtaking in its arrogance, but it's certainly of a piece with everything the Bush administration has done. Then on March 19th, which was, I believe, the anniversary, the fifth-year anniversary of the beginning of the most recent war in Iraq, although you could say that the war really began in 1998 when the Congress, under Bill Clinton, the Senate and the House of Representatives passed the so-called Iraq Liberation Act, which really set the dials, once again, for a war with Iraq at some time or another. But the anniversary of the beginning of so-called Operation Iraqi Freedom was, I believe, on the 19th. And on that day, Dana Perino, who's the White House spokeswoman, was asked by Helen Thomas about this statement by Dick Cheney, the so response, so what? The public doesn't matter. What Helen Thomas said is, the American people are being asked to die and pay for this, and you're saying they don't have a say in this war? And Perino says, no, I didn't say that, Helen.
Hold on, so we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William was simply talking about a White House press conference where Helen Thomas had asked the White House representative, you know, about Dick Cheney's remark when asked about, you know, the fact that the majority of the American people, two-thirds of the American people, don't support the war, and Dick Cheney's response was, so, no, they don't. And so Helen Thomas brought this subject up at a White House press conference. Please go on with the story there, William.
Yeah, what she said was, don't the American people have an input into this? And Dana Perino said, this president was elected, and you had input. The American people have input every 4 years, and that's the way our system is set up. Now, harken back to January of 2005. George W. Bush had just secured a second term. Some say he was elected. Some say that he stole the election. I'm of the opinion that the latter is more true than the former. But he had just secured re-election in a contest between himself and a completely interchangeable Democratic rival who came from the same Yale Skull and Bone Society, John Kerry, somebody who really didn't challenge Bush on any of the principles, but merely on the matter of implementation of the policy with respect to Iraq and just about every other public issue of consequence. So in January 2005, Mr. Bush was asked once again by the Washington Post, this redoubtable organ of the establishment, as to whether or not there was going to be any change with respect to the policy in Iraq and the larger war on terror. And Mr. Bush screwed his features into that familiar smirk and said, well, no, you see, we had an accountability moment. We had an accountability moment. It was called 2004 election. And because he had managed to secure re-election, apparently that gave him a plenary indulgence for everything he had done in his first term that was unconstitutional, illegal, or both, by virtue of the fact that he was able to win a second term that expunged any misconduct, any misrepresentation. It justified, after the fact, the lies that were told, the conscious, deliberate lies that were told by volume by Bush and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice et al. To manipulate the public into the war in Iraq. it justified after the fact the implementation of policies with respect to torture that was going on as early as 2002, if not earlier than that. The full throttle assault on the Bill of Rights, all these things were made right by virtue of the fact that Bush won a second term. So as far as they're concerned, that settles the question. They're no longer accountable. The consent was given, and consent is irrevocable. That's their point of view. As it happens, that's an old Leninist concept called democratic centralism. Democratic centralism was the notion that the leadership of the party or any subdivision of the party in the old Soviet Union, meaning, of course, the Communist Party of Soviet Russia, the leadership of the party would allow debate within parameters it would define, and then once a course of action was chosen, the course of action was always that ordained by the oligarchy ruling the Communist Party. You had the democratic right to ratify the decisions by your rulers, and once you'd given your consent, that consent cannot be withdrawn. That was Lenin's concept of democratic centralism. You can see the same thing in play in Cuba during most of Fidel Castro's reign. He actually said on many occasions that whatever decision he makes is by definition democratic because he embodies the democratic will of the people of Cuba. That's a concept actually that comes from Lenin by way of Lenin's largely disavowed disciple, Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler created a variation on this concept called Führer Principle, or the leader principle. And it once again held that because the leader of the National Socialist Party of Russia, of Germany, rather, embodied the will of the Volk, of the people, that whatever he did had to be considered democratic because he had an accountability moment when his party won a plurality in 1933 and he was put in a position to become chancellor of Germany. That was his accountability moment, and from henceforth, he was to be considered the embodiment of the democratic will of the German nation. And after he had secured full control over the executive branch of the German government, and he was able to do everything he did legally on account of the fact that the Weimar Constitution permitted the executive to rule by decree in the event of an emergency. That was one of many weaknesses in that Constitution that proved to be fatal. Once he was in that position, out went the decree that there would be no second revolution. In other words, they were not going to permit any backtracking from the point where the National Socialists had obtained power. And that's very much of a piece with what we have in the Bush administration right now. Admittedly, the Bush administration has a somewhat milder case of the same totalitarian affliction, at least for domestic consumption. It seems mild to us. It certainly doesn't seem mild to the Iraqis who are on the receiving end of their supposed benevolence, their liberation. It doesn't seem mild to the people who get caught in the coils of the Homeland Security machinery, whether you're talking about innocent American citizens or innocent people of other nationalities who end up being sent by way of extraordinary rendition to places like Egypt and Syria and elsewhere to be tortured by subcontractors of the Bush regime. But it seems mild to us right now on account of the fact that we're not facing the full-blown affliction. But it is of a piece, once again, with these totalitarian philosophies. I remember a few years ago, and this is something that I mentioned in my book, my most recent book, Liberty and Eclipse, there was a congressional hearing involving a Justice Department official who was being chastised for any one of a number of times where Mr. Bush had simply dispensed with the law and imposed his own will in defiance of the law and the constitutional powers of Congress. And the colloquy before the Congress ended with this individual, this person from the Justice Department, being asked, was the president right when what he said was factually wrong, and what the Justice Department official said was, well, the president is always right, which sounded better in the original German. I mean, the conceit in the National Socialist scheme of things was that whatever the Führer said was by definition right and correct, irrespective of what the law said, because he was the embodiment of the law. And you get the same attitude being manifest by the Bush administration with respect to these so-called signing statements that George Bush has been issuing, whereby he will sign into law a measure which has been passed by Congress that would meet with the constitutional definition of an appropriately passed law. Once it's signed by the president, it becomes a law. But what Mr. Bush has done until very recently, he's eschewed the use of a veto, which is the only negative that he has under the Constitution. The only way that he can dispense with legislation is by a veto. but he would eschew the veto, and instead he would issue a signing statement setting forth his reasons for setting aside elements of the law that he found to be unacceptable. Now, that's not a constitutionally sound approach, obviously. What he's doing is he's attesting, even as he signs a bill into law, his intent to violate the law that he has just signed, which is, of course, a prima facie case. Every instance of that sort presents a prima facie case for impeachment. But until recently, that's been Mr. Bush's habit, and he's still been issuing signing statements. Some of them have to do with the use of torture, which has been illegal and unconstitutional, immoral and unchristian for the entire length of Mr. Bush's tenure. But with respect to the laws that have been passed by Congress making ever so slight impositions on the supposed power to torture, Mr. Bush had been issuing signing statements simply saying that he would interpret the law according to his judgment of what is best for our national interest. Once again, this is something completely foreign to our constitutional traditions, but anybody who studied the totalitarian executives of the 20th century would see that that's very much in that tradition. It's certainly not without precedent, the history of Germany and Russia and Cuba and Romania and China, North Korea, all these other unfortunate countries have fallen under the totalitarian heel. So I think it's important to recognize that we do have, as you say, Dr. Standis, unelected oligarchy that is actually running things. And to the extent that we have an elected government, at least with respect to the executive branch, it operates like a limited-term dictatorship. We have elections in this country. Who knows how soundly they're run? I'm certainly not competent to assess whether or not a lot of the allegations of wholesale theft of elections are reliable. They seem plausible to me, but I'm a layman on those matters, and I don't bring any specialized expertise to that issue. But we do have elections. At least in some places, they run responsibly and with a reasonable amount of competence. But it doesn't really matter if the choices we get in terms of candidates are completely interchangeable, and if the candidates, once they assume office, are not bound by the limitations of their powers as defined in the Constitution. And so that's, I think, what people have to recognize, is not whether we have elections. Almost every country, apart from monarchies, have elections. China has elections. North Korea has elections. You're required to vote in North Korea, just as you were required to vote in communist Albania and so forth. The question is not whether or not you have elections. The question is, what are those officials permitted to do once they assume office? And it's not even really a question of how long they're in office. I mean, certainly we're familiar with dictators who are rulers for life. We had a president like that. His name was FDR. He was elected to four terms, and he died in office. He probably would have stayed in office for the entire fourth term and a fifth term if his health would have held out. I mean, he was our first president for life. But it doesn't matter whether or not you've got a short-term dictatorship or whether you have regular elections. If the person who is exercising the power is not limited by law, and if, as is the case with President Bush, the official sees fit to set aside all the limitations on his office with respect to entangling our nation in a war, perpetuating that war after every rationale for it has been exposed as either a fallacy or a lie, and then employing the powers of his office to designate any person he sees fit to inflict his will upon as somebody outside the protection of the law, and consign that person to perpetual imprisonment, torture, and perhaps summary execution. I mean, those are all powers that Mr. Bush is exercising right now, and unless they are revoked and some semblance of constitutional discipline reimposed, it's just going to get worse from here.
And I certainly agree with you. I think that we should be very deeply concerned about the president signing policies where he simply says, you know, I'm not going to abide by the law, and there's nothing you can do about it. And, of course, what is really even more disturbing is the fact that the leaders of both the Republican and the Democratic Party are going right along with it. An awful lot of people voted Democratic there in 2006 because they wanted to get out of the war, and that's why the Republicans lost both the House and the Senate. But the voters didn't understand that both political parties are controlled by exactly the same people, and those people were intent upon continuing the war in Iraq for many, many, many more years. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Go right ahead.
Not just the war in Iraq. I mean, obviously, they're thinking about, and they're doing everything they can to try to expand the war into Iran and Syria and elsewhere. And keep us bogged down in the Near East, in the Middle East, for basically forever. I mean, John McCain, the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, has made it clear that he sees nothing amiss with the United States involvement in Iraq for the next century or so. And always the line that we get when people are talking about the length of the war, and as you pointed out the other day, Dr. Stan, we've been involved in Iraq for longer than when we were involved in World War II. And put this in perspective, I mean, that is a long time to be involved in a campaign, a military campaign overseas. We have people circulating, being tasked over and over again to return for multiple tours to Iraq. There are units that are on their fourth and fifth tours of duty in Iraq. I know of one instance where a fellow who has two Purple Hearts already is going back for his fourth or fifth tour of duty in Iraq. It's just unconscionable the way that they're grinding our military to powder and turning out not only thousands of killed in action, but thousands or even tens of thousands of very seriously wounded or psychologically crippled people as a result of the attrition of this war over in Iraq. But this is, as you say, a bipartisan undertaking, and it's not as if either party, the leader of either party, the presumptive leader, which would be the presidential nominee, it's not as if either of the main nominees or potential nominees wants to do anything about extricating our country from this undertaking. I mean, John McCain is indecently eager to see the war spread to Iran and elsewhere. And his way of encouraging the public with respect to the prospects that await us is to say that we're going to have more wars, we're going to have more killed in action, we're going to deal with more instances of post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, that's not exactly the most inspirational line I've heard, but that's John McCain's perspective on things. Hillary Clinton is very much of a piece with Bush and McCain with respect to the policy toward Iraq. The only difference, of course, is that she plays to a constituency in the Democratic Party that wants to see us withdraw from Iraq. But if you take a look at her voting record and take a look at her policy positions, she is not talking about getting out of Iraq anytime soon. The same is true with Barack Obama. Barack Obama is capturing the Democratic nomination, most likely. There's a possibility that he might end up being upended by recent developments or might be deemed unelectable by the superdelegates in that party. But in any case, the reason why, one chief reason why he has so much support in the primaries is because he is perceived as the anti-war candidate. And taking a look at his record, I can't see where he has ever given any tangible support to the anti-war cause, the cause of getting us out of Iraq, defunding the war, bringing the troops home. He's made it clear in speeches that he's given to bodies like the Chicago World Affairs Council. It's not called the World Affairs Council. It used to be called the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, but they changed the name so as to avoid confusion with the actual CFR. But Mr. Obama has given speeches in which he makes it clear that he's not opposed to overseas military engagements. He just prefers that they be fought more intelligently than the Iraq War and that they be fought more overtly through multilateral means, meaning through the United Nations and its subsidiaries and auxiliaries. And so you're dealing here with having the deck stacked entirely against the interest of asserting American independence and withdrawing our troops from this completely useless and destructive war in Iraq.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is William Greig. He's just talking about all of the candidates, John McCain, Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, all of them, of course, to continue the war in Iraq. There is no way out, since all of the candidates will push it. The only candidate who said we want to get our troops out was Ron Paul, and of course, he was totally ignored by the media. Why? Because the media is controlled by people who want to continue the war. And although Ron Paul's message, certainly supporting doing away with the income tax, cutting taxes, doing away with the Federal Reserve System, returning to constitutional government, is something that most Americans would agree with. Unfortunately, Ron Paul had no possibility of getting the nomination because the media controls the reality of so many people, and besides that, they rig a lot of the elections with these phony voting machines, electronic voting machines, and anybody who has any question about that needs to get the new DVD we're carrying called Uncounted. That's Uncounted, goes into the voting machines, and how they stole the 2004 election, and I don't think it would have made a bit of difference whether you had John Kerry there or George Bush. Only, of course, by having George Bush there, why you assured the ultimate destruction of the Republican Party and the high ideals that it once stood for. Please go ahead, William.
Yeah, I want to make it clear once again, I find that entirely credible. I've not done any independent research on the subject of the stealing of elections. I've not really gotten into the details of the works that are available by people who have done that original research, but on the basis of my lambent review, if you will, of a number of reports from people of great sobriety and competence, I'm convinced that you can make a very good case that 2004 represented a stolen election, and that what we've been seeing in the primaries on both sides of the aisle across this very narrow divide between the Republicans and the Democrats, you've seen on both sides a number of instances where elections, primary elections, have been stolen. And that, I think, is something that deserves a lot more attention than it's getting, and I can't understand why people are so stolidly indifferent to this, because it's a huge and infuriating scandal. If you believe in accountability of any sort, you have to have the integrity of the voting process, because otherwise we just simply don't have any peaceful legal means of holding people accountable. But I wanted to talk just a little bit more about Mr. Obama and some of the things that have been said during the last week about his background. Barack Obama is a very appealing man. He has a demeanor and a composure which inspire confidence. He's an exceptional orator in terms of the way that he's able to convey to a large audience the impression that he's speaking to people as individuals and addressing them as adults. And it's a very attractive quality in any person, particularly among politicians, because we're used to being condescended to by politicians and being fed a diet of transparent lies. Well, yeah, Barack Obama has the aspect of somebody who's leveling with you and trying to tell you things that you would find intriguing on the face of what he is saying. That being said, he doesn't really say a whole lot of substance. He's somebody who seems to be saying that he himself is the message. And one of his favorite applause lines is, "We are the change we've been waiting for," which is a rather peculiarly phrased variation on the old lounge singer's applause line, "Why don't you give yourselves a hand?" You know, that's the sort of a thing that's always going to go over well in just about any audience. But in the recent weeks, of course, we've seen where Jeremiah Wright of the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, which is the church to which Barack Obama has belonged for over 20 years, where he was married, where his daughters were baptized. Jeremiah Wright is his spiritual advisor and very close friend. Mr. Wright has fallen under the scrutiny of the media for a number of speeches he's given, where he said some very incendiary things about the problem, as he perceives it, of ubiquitous white racism, and also some very scandalous things, at least in the ears of some people, about American foreign policy. And the thing I find really interesting about this, apart from the fact that, you know, Mr. Wright's an interesting subject in and of himself to explore, is that the media has focused its outrage primarily on what Wright has said about our foreign policy. When Jeremiah Wright was talking about the fact that after September 11th, he was saying that we're finding the chickens are coming home to roost because our government was the government that bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki and didn't bat an eye. Our government has promoted terrorism abroad. It's done all these horrible things that resulted in mass casualties of the innocent worldwide. And now that we've been struck, we're finding that things aren't quite as pleasant to be on the receiving end. And the thing that I find interesting about that is that there's really nothing that he said there, with the possible exception of some things he said about South Africa, with which I'd take exception. I mean, when he talks about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he's been accused of peddling anti-Americanism for condemning the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Douglas MacArthur condemned the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is William Gregg, and he was just commenting on the on the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I can tell you a little bit about that. I know from firsthand experience because I had the opportunity of spending several weekends with General Albert Wedemeyer, who was in command of all the forces there, and both Chinese and American forces in the Chinese sector during the latter part of the Second World War, and certainly in the time leading up to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And he confirmed for me, at least in part, the article that appeared in the Chicago Tribune, which we have. I think it was August 15, 1945, the day they signed the peace agreement on the Missouri, that pointed out that the Japanese had been trying to surrender for 6 months, and the American government wouldn't let the Japanese surrender. If any of you'd like a copy of that, I would be glad to send you. I got the article personally from the Chicago Tribune with their permission to reproduce it. But General Albert Wedemeyer told me that that they had intercepted information, communications between the Japanese and the Russians, and of course after the bombing of Hiroshima, the Japanese were offering to surrender, and of course instead of transmitting that information to Washington, D.C., the Russians went ahead and invaded Manchuria and certainly took over the country, that part of the nation, and then took all their industry and took all their weapons. But Washington, D.C. knew the Japanese wanted to surrender before they dropped the second bomb. Of course, they knew they wanted to surrender before they dropped the first bomb. But they went ahead and killed those people anyway, and that's unconscionable, because war is fought against soldiers, not against civilians, and you're not supposed to be incinerating 100,000 civilians in every town you bomb. And yet, of course, that's exactly what they do, and of course, by so doing, why they have won simply the disrespect and dishonor to our country.
Yeah, it's interesting. As I pointed out, Douglas MacArthur opposed the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Patton opposed the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You don't find anybody who's a more suitable example of pure martial pugnacity in our history than Patton. And he was overtly opposed. He was vehemently opposed to the widespread practice of what is called strategic bombing, but what he called it was just pure butchery, where he'd be bombing the centers of cities. He was appalled by what was going on during the European campaign, where population centers were being targeted. And he, in his reminiscences, War as I Knew It, he talks about how utterly subhuman it is.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is simply noting that both General Douglas MacArthur and, of course, General George Patton were against the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and certainly the slaughter of innocent civilians by the American bombing patterns during the Second World War. It was inhumane. They were war crimes, but after all, to the victor goes the spoils. And when you win, why, of course, nobody is there to challenge you. Well, before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site, how they can get copies of your new book, and I'm hoping one of these days I'm going to get a chance to see it.
Oh, I am too. It's the source of some frustration and embarrassment to me, but I promise we're going to get them to you. It's just difficult because, as I pointed out, we're scattered across the countryside, the Welsh Foundation. Sometimes the lines of communication don't operate as well as they should. To get to my blog and my writings and to order the book, the best place to go is to WriteSource, the WriteSource. The website address is www.writesourceonline.com. That's WriteSource Online, one word, writesourceonline.com. The WriteSource is a web page, a news page, a source for commentary, video links, and all kinds of other information that is maintained by the Welsh Foundation, for which I work as an editor-at-large. And if you go to the homepage of the WriteSource, writesourceonline.com, at the top there's a banner ad for my new book, Liberty and Eclipse, entitled Liberty and Eclipse, because I believe that hopefully we can reverse what we're seeing right now. And an eclipse is a passing thing. It's not a permanent condition. I'm hoping that we'll be able to look back at some future point and see where it became very dark, but we were able to do something about reversing the darkness. The full title of the book is Liberty in Eclipse, The War on Terror and the Rise of the Homeland Security State. It's a little over 300 pages long. It contains several hundred endnotes, and its purpose is to document and to condemn in detail the outright subversion of our common law heritage of liberty under law and the installation of a fully operational, albeit in its early stages, fully operational garrison state. The Homeland Security concept is completely subversive of the Constitution. The Constitution dictates that the government is our servant, that we have authority over our government. We delegate to our government certain powers, certain authorities, which are to be used to carry out specific missions, and if those powers are abused, we revoke those powers. Well, the Homeland Security concept dictates that we are the chief threat to our government, that the government should be protected uber alle, that it should use whatever means at its disposal, including our lifeblood and our treasure, if necessary, in order to protect those who exercise government power and those who are politically favored by the people who are exercising government power. And the Homeland Security concept dictates that we are, once again, the enemy. We are encouraged to look abroad for potential threats. There are some nasty people. There are nasty regimes in this world. But the chief and most important threat that we will confront, the one that can do us the most harm, that poses the single biggest threat to everything we hold dear, is not some distant troglodyte in a cave in Afghanistan or Pakistan. It's not some distant regime that does nasty things to its own people. It's the regime that governs us here at home. And the purpose of Liberty and the Eclipse is to help people understand that and get angry about what's happened to our country. And then if you go once again to the right source, rightsourceonline.com, scroll down about a third of the way down the page, the front page, and look to the left-hand side of the screen, you'll find my photograph, and there's a link that will take you to my daily blog. It's called Pro Libertate. It's a Latin phrase. It means for freedom. It's, interestingly enough, the Latin phrase, which is on the Wallace family crest, as in William Wallace from the movie Braveheart, my favorite film. And my blog is updated between 3 and 5 times a week. And more or less, the beat that I cover consists of keeping an eye on and exposing the multifarious ways that the government that rules us is an enemy of human liberty and human progress. And unfortunately, that's a very full docket all the time. I always find myself getting behind 4 or 5 subjects that I want to write about. And I'm gratified to see that it is getting a lot of attention, and that the reaction I'm getting from people is that they're starting to understand just how dire our situation is. A lot of the people that are reading what I have to write are well-informed people already. But I do know that I get a steady, it's small, but it's an increasing, a steady traffic from people who are just now starting to realize that it's getting dark. It's getting dark, and it's getting desperate, and it's getting scary. And so I'm cursing the darkness in my blog, but hopefully I'm using the friction of my outrage to spark a candle or two that'll help to dispel a little of the darkness.
Well, as they always used to say, you know, better to light one candle than to curse the darkness. So
yeah,
that's what you're doing. You're doing a great job. And I hear
that.
All sorts of good comments about your blog and, of course, your message. But go right ahead.
Well, I appreciate that. We've been talking about the, I think, contrived controversy over Jeremiah T. Wright. There are a lot of things you can condemn the guy for, but when he talks about the practice of our government of international terrorism, which is what you'd have to describe it, and he cites Hiroshima and Nagasaki and a couple of other instances of that sort to illustrate the terroristic element of government policy, he's on firm ground here. And it was that element of what he said that really provided most of the grist for the mills of public outrage. That we were talking about the bombings, the atomic bombings of Japan, pointing out that people like Douglas MacArthur and General George Patton and others whose patriotism was unassailable condemned that attack for very good and sound reasons. Colonel McCormick of blessed memory, the former publisher of the Chicago Tribune, a man who was targeted by the FDR regime for imprisonment of worse because he had opposed both domestically and internationally what FDR was doing, did expose in 1945 the fact the Japanese had been trying to surrender for about a year by the time the atomic bombing took place. And the mythology we've been fed is that we had to bomb them in order to get them to surrender unconditionally. We really shouldn't have been pushing for unconditional surrender. If you take a look at the canons of Christian warfare going back to the Peace of Westphalia of 1648, it's understood that you do not seek unconditional surrender from an enemy because it would lead you to do things like attack civilians, commit atrocities against non-combatants. It was the horrible things that happened during the 30 years war leading up to Westphalia that led the powers, the Christian powers of Europe, to enact certain understandings into the canons of conventional law governing warfare that were intended to prevent this advance to barbarism, as A.J. P. Veal put it in the title of his book on strategic bombing in World War II. But the thing I find really interesting about the attack on Nagasaki in particular, apart from the fact that it was completely gratuitous, is the fact that Nagasaki, in addition to being a civilian population center, was the area in Japan where most of the Christians lived. That was the largest concentration of Christian Japanese in the entire country, and they had suffered horribly in the decades and centuries leading up to the atomic bombing of their town in August of 1945. There were thousands and thousands of martyrs that were made because, as was the case with the early Christian church in Rome, these Japanese Christians refused to recognize the deity, the supposed deity, the emperor. In ancient Rome, you were required to offer a pinch of incense on the at the shrine of the emperor, and there in Nagasaki you were required to go to a Shinto shrine and clap your hands so as to summon the spirits of whatever supposedly divine entities were behind the incarnate will of Japan and the emperor. And the Christians of Nagasaki refused to do that. And after so many of them had been put to the blade by the pagan government of Japan over those many years, you had thousands of them, or tens of thousands of them, immolated instantly by the pagan government running the United States in 1945. It's an egregious offense historically. It's a screaming, abhorrent atrocity. It's a stench in the nostrils of the Almighty that our government, and the government ruling our country at the time, for reasons that won't withstand strategic analysis and certainly moral inspection, bombed that town. There's a chapter in a terrific book by the late Eric Ritter von Quaynot-Ledeen. The book is called Leftism Revisited. That talks about this and goes into detail about what a world historic outrage this was for a purportedly Christian country to bomb Nagasaki. And then to add ludicrous insult to insuperable injury, just a couple of years ago, the dimwit in chief, George Bush, goes over to Nagasaki and he claps his hands at the Shinto shrine so as to summon the spirits. Now, this man professes to be a Christian. I don't know his heart. I don't know his status with the Lord. That's not my concern. What I do want to point out is that thousands, if not tens of thousands, of Christians in Japan were put to death because they refused to do what George Bush did on that visit. They refused to engage in this act of worship, because that's what it is. And because they refused to do so, they were put to death. And Mr. Bush blithely goes to that shrine, claps his hands as if it matters nothing. And it does matter nothing to him. I mean, that's, once again, something over which he's a steward. I don't have stewardship over his soul. I just like to point out that somebody who professes to be a Christian ought to be mindful of such things. But Jeremiah Wright, in condemning the bombings in Japan, the atomic bombings in Japan, was not being anti-American any more than MacArthur or Patton were anti-American for condemning strategic bombing, for condemning our foreign policy that cultivates terrorism abroad and results in the death of thousands, tens of thousands, or hundreds of thousands of innocent people. Mr. Wright was not being anti-American. He was displaying patriotism in its finest form. He loves our country enough to criticize the government that rules us. The problem I have with Jeremiah Wright is that he is a practitioner of black liberation theology, which is a really nasty form of culture-specific Marxist subversive theology that's designed to get people to start thinking specifically in terms of exclusivist ethnic identity. The idea that your identity is defined by the color of your skin and the ethnic origin of your ancestors, and that your status with respect to government and the things the government can confer upon you is entirely dependent upon your identity within that group. You get, of course, variations of that involving white supremacists. You get variations of that with La Raza and what you might call Latino supremacists. You find all kinds of variations. There's a very rainbow coalition of ethnic, exclusive ethnic nationalisms of this sort. They're all very pernicious, in my opinion, because they all lead to the type of politics that are exclusivist, first of all, and ultimately eliminationist. That's the sort of thing that we found in European history in the 20th century, and actually the late 19th and early 20th centuries, is the emergence of these forms of nationalism that tend to be acquisitive and militantly intolerant of others, and you end up with horrible situations of the sort that blacken the pages of history with respect to the Balkans, and you can see this still going on in some parts of Europe. Kosovo, the conflict over Kosovo, the conflict in Bosnia, and of course Lebanon has been historically embroiled in this kind of nonsense as well. But the Trinity Trinity Church, so-called Church of Christ, is sort of a full-service black nationalist congregation. And its doctrine is focused not so much on the redemptive work of Jesus Christ, which is, of course, the central focus of the Christian faith, particularly at this time of year, but on the idea that what really matters is that you have to perceive Jesus Christ as a liberator of the black people specifically. And the message of the New Testament is that in Jesus Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek nor Gentile. There's neither male nor female. We don't lose those elements of our identity, but once we become part of the Christian faith, what matters is our standing before Christ and not these other incidental aspects of our identity. Well, in identity religions of this sort, it's all a matter of your melanin content and your ethnic origin. And the person who was Jeremiah Wright's mentor, his theological mentor, was a Union Theological Seminary trained academic by the name of James Cone, and the fact that he was from the Union Theological Seminary tells you everything you need to know. I mean, that's one of these entities that has done more than enough to propagate a heresy of just about any variety you can imagine, and it's been the beneficiary of a lot of money and a lot of influence and largesse directed its way by our good friends, the tax-exempt foundations, with the Rockefellers leading the way. The Rockefeller Foundations, starting in the early 20th century, did what they could to cultivate and nurture heresy, and they've enjoyed a rich harvest, a very bounteous harvest from those investments. But according to Cone, this is Cone's theology in a nutshell, and this, once again, is the theology embraced by Jeremiah Wright and preached at his church, where Barack Obama has been a communicant now for 20 years. I'm quoting now from Cone. Black theology refuses to accept a God who is not identified totally with the goals of the black community. If God is not for us and against white people, think of that for a second. If God is not for us and against white people, then he is a murderer and we had better kill him. The task of black theology is to kill gods who do not belong to the black community. Black theology will accept only the love of God, which participates in the destruction of the white enemy. What we need is the divine love as expressed in black power, which is the power of black people to destroy their oppressors here and now by any means at their disposal. Unless God is participating in this holy activity, we must reject his love. But think of that for a second. I mean, the basic and fundamental commandments that we are given through revelation at Sinai have to do with the identity of God, what he expects of us, and how we are supposed to treat each other. And they all begin with the fact that we don't get to define God according to our own whims and desires. We don't get the luxury of a customizable God. God simply is. We're to accept him. We're to serve him. We're not to try to fashion him into our own image and make him serve our own conceit. And once we understand who God is, we're supposed to treat our neighbors with certain types of respect and deference. That's what the Ten Commandments are all about. Whereas this version of liberation theology, and all of them have their roots in Marx, and if you pull the roots up a little bit deeper, you'll find that they all go back to the Illuminati. Abby Barrowell, in his memoirs exposing Jacobinism, talks at great length and goes into substantial detail talking about how the Illuminists in revolutionary Germany and revolutionary France of the 18th century were trying to recast Jesus Christ as a political revolutionary and trying to create from him a social and political reformer who would use violence in order to accomplish certain radical ends. So you get that line running through Marx and into contemporary colonialist politics by the 1950s and 1960s. And the distillate of it comes out in these incredibly blasphemous things that were taught by James Cone, and which are recirculated now in the Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, which is a 6,000-member church and one of the biggest mega churches in the Midwest. That's where Barack Obama, as according to his own account, that's where he learned about the Jesus he worships. That's where he learned the variant of Christianity he believes in. Now, he has tried to distance himself from some of the more outre things that Wright has been saying, and he particularly took issue with the things that Jeremiah Wright said that I think are fundamentally correct about our foreign policy, which I think is significant. And he's not thoroughly disowned the guy, and I do admit that I have a sort of sneaking respect for the fact that Obama didn't entirely disown this man, because so often you find people strategically disposing of friends once they become impediments to their political ambition.
Well, that's we'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, William, go right ahead.
Yeah, but the thing about Jeremiah Wright and Obama, Barack Obama, that I think you have to bear in mind is that Jeremiah Wright, this disciple of James Cone, the man who was talking about fashioning a God in the image of Afrocentrism, a God whose entire purpose is to elevate the black community and to destroy the white community, that Jeremiah Wright, the man who's been teaching this message there in that church, is the one who created, according to Barack Obama, Obama's spiritual understanding of the world. And it was a sermon by Reverend Wright that provided the title of Barack Obama's autobiography, The Audacity of Hope. It was a 1990 sermon. It's an interesting sermon in that it contains a lot of really commendable and meritorious things. For instance, there are a couple of paragraphs in that 1990 sermon that condemn the hypocrisy of apparently respectable men who are unfaithful to their wives, and it condemns the short-sightedness and the sinful behavior of younger people who engage in sexual immorality and drug use and things of that sort. That's all to the good, and it also talks about the fact that when you're deprived of everything else but the thin thread of hope, that you should cling to that hope because God does answer prayers. To that extent, it's a good sermon. But if you read it, you're struck by the fundamental absence of the basic Christian message in that speech. That I'd call it a speech rather than a sermon, because there's nothing in there that's meant to direct people in the listening audience toward the source of solace and salvation, who is Jesus Christ. If you're a Christian, that's what you believe. That's rather absent from that, conspicuously absent from that sermon, or that speech, if you will. And so when you take a look at that and you realize that Obama had been nurtured in a church that is steeped in exclusivist Afrocentrist liberation theology, and also when you understand that his wife, who's an attorney of sorts, was a very well-compensated diversity consultant. In other words, she was one of these people who'd be involved in these shakedowns of corporations to make sure that they were obeying the canons of political correctness. You've got grounds for concern here, because the type of perspective that represents is rather at odds with the cultivated image of Barack Obama as somebody who would bring about reconciliation. I think what's happening, and I can't help but believe that this is deliberate, is that the Obama candidacy is generating a lot of excitement among younger voters, idealistic voters in the Democratic Party, who have a certain set of ideals. I disagree with most of them, but they are ideals.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to just break off, and then we'll bring it right back up.
All right,
fine. Well, of course, William is talking about how the Obama campaign is bringing a lot of idealistic young people into the Democratic Party, who really are looking for change, are looking for a better America. But and pick up the thought there.
Yeah, but the thing is, I think what's going to happen is that they're actually setting the stage for a lot of intercommunal and ethnic friction here, because Obama, his public persona notwithstanding, is the product of this milieu of embittered ethnic preoccupation. And now that you've seen the saturation coverage given to his preacher, who's very much a black nationalist, it's going to start getting people to think more in terms of the ethnic collective they belong to. We're hearing talk about the white vote versus the black vote versus the Hispanic vote, and people are being put into these tiny little categories once again, which is exactly where the people who would rule us want us to be. They want us to be thinking in terms of these incidental characteristics and identifying with people who are likewise put into the same box with us.
And we're going to have to
set us off against each other.
You're exactly right. They want to play one American against the other. And I think that is one of the major thrusts of the Obama candidacy. William, we could go on for hours. I know you could, but we're out of time. God bless you. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week.
Have a great Easter.
Bye-bye. And you too. Wonderful. Bye-bye. And Chris, that's right. This is Good Friday, and certainly I want all of us to remember that certainly we're not going to solve this problem politically or ideologically or culturally. This is a spiritual battle, and what a wonderful time it is to reflect that this Sunday represents the resurrection of our Lord. And certainly if Jesus was not resurrected, then we have no hope in the world. Absolutely not. And so we talk about the issues, and I'm very, very concerned about the growing racism. I think it's wonderful that so many white people have voted for Obama, despite the fact that he's black. But, of course, what we're hearing now, of course, is only going to tend to more crystallized people. They're going to say, oh, well, the people wouldn't vote for him because he was black. No, I think they wouldn't vote for him because he represents hatred of white people. In fact, his wife had said that, you know, for the first time, she was proud of him to be an American. What a wonderful, terrible thing to say. Are we to believe that that Obama's wife was always ashamed to be an American before this? Now, I may disagree a great deal with what our government is doing, but I'm still proud of the heritage of this country, and I'm going to reclaim it for my children and my grandchildren and my great-grandchildren, and actually I have one at the present time, a great-grandchild, and I'd love to see her be able to grow up in a free country where the values that I was trained in when I was young are paramount in our society. Well, this is the time when I want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, our number 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America, our values, our traditions, our religion are under attack today. Indeed, there is an effort to destroy the Christian faith of our nation, and they're doing a pretty good job about it. More and more of our people, even within the church, are beginning to turn to other views, turning away from the traditions of Christianity, the belief in the sinfulness of man, the promise of salvation by belief in Jesus Christ our Lord, and they're looking for other ways of understanding God through meditation, through contemplative prayer, for walking into labyrinths, for gaining altered sense of consciousness, as the ancient and mystical monks did in the past. And of course, this is an affront to God. There's nothing wrong with the simple story that Jesus Christ was born of a Virgin Mary, grew to adulthood, was crucified and died and was resurrected. And it is through belief in him that we have the promise of salvation. That's what Christianity is all about. It's a message of Christianity. And that hope of salvation is available to everyone listening to the program tonight. So at this time, let me simply wish you all a wonderful and joyous Easter Sunday, and I hope you'll be in prayer, and you'll contemplate about what's going on today, about the spiritual battle, but the fact that the Christian message is absolutely true. Until next week, may the Lord be with you.